it was published in 1927, Yuri Ilyich's novel Envy was celebrated by the Soviet establishment as a condemnation of the bourgeois psyche. But 2 years later, Ilyich came under suspicion when it dawned on communist officials that the novel was meant as a satire. Vladimir Nabokov has called Ilyich's story of a plot by a young bourgeois against a sausage mogul the greatest novel produced in the Soviet Union, and Envy is the subject of the fifth installment of our summer series on underappreciated literature. I'm very pleased that it brings Marion Schwartz to our show. She translated Envy for the recent New York Review of Books reissue. Welcome to our show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Ilyich wrote for a union newspaper that also published works by Mikhail Bulgakov and Isaac Babel. What sets Ilyich apart from the other important Soviet writers of his generation?
Well, first of all, he had a great deal in common. He came from Odessa, and he was part of a concentration of quite remarkable writers. Ilfim Petrov were there, Babel was there. These were all people who had rejected the bourgeois world, they welcomed the revolution, and they were part of a great deal of artistic excitement and innovation that was, you saw in the art world, you saw it in movies, you saw it in many different spheres. Ilyich was not that different from them, for one thing, he was a one-book man.
Mm-hmm. Well, circumstances to some degree determined that, didn't they?
To a certain extent, although the book that came out previously, The Three Fat Men, which was his fairy tale, essentially covered the same issue. It's hard to imagine being a writer in the 20s in the Soviet Union or Soviet Russia and treating any subject other than the revolution. All those writers treated that subject. And they all were considered, perhaps Ilyich more than the others, with the fate of the individual in the context of the revolution.
And they all, to varying degrees, became disillusioned fairly quickly, didn't they?
They both did. Both Babel and Ilyich spoke at the 1934 Congress of Writers. It was the first Congress of Soviet Writers. And they were both under the gun because neither one of them was producing the kind of material that the Bolshevik critics wanted.
But then later Mayakovsky and so many others, people who had made major commitments to the revolution, perhaps because this book came out, it was published during a period of transition, wasn't it? Lenin had died and Stalin had come to power.
1927 was an incredible year. The number of things that came together, not only, well, of course, Lenin was dead. Lenin had been dead for a few years.
Yeah, 24.
Stalin was beginning to consolidate power. NEP had been abolished, the new economic policy. So you were starting to see deprivation in the cities, famine, not famine yet, but shortages of supplies. You had Trotsky expelled. You also had, very interesting, I think, is that was the year Zamyatin published We. Now, he had to publish it in an émigré journal in Paris. So it was a year, I would say, when I think many of these writers were seeing the writing on the wall. And Mayakovsky, of course, only lasted another 3 years. He was dead he killed himself in 1930.
Envy was originally published in a literary magazine in a serial form?
Yes, that's fairly common, I would say most of the novels we know as novels were initially published serially.
But do you think that determined the way it's divided into two parts? The first part is told in first person, and then we go to third person.
I don't know actually how many issues it appeared over. I don't know if it was if one part was in one issue or if it was perhaps broken up even more.
Ilyich's protagonist, Nikolai Kavalerov, would it be?
Kavalerov.
Kavalerov jumps from observation to observation. In fact, he seems a little unhinged. Is he supposed to be unreliable?
I think he's quite unreliable, and I would not exactly call him a hero. I think that's what's interesting. The people who are supposed to be heroes, who have the outward signs of being heroes, and who fooled the Soviet critics into thinking they were heroes, or of course not heroes, you'll notice when you read the book, or perhaps not notice until later, it'll occur to you that all the people who are supposed to be positive are portrayed only through people who hate them.
In a way, it seems to be a child of Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground.
Yes, it's definitely been compared to that. I think they were doing something new, though. I think they were confronting a dilemma that humanity had not seen before. And, of course, it was leading to confronting totalitarianism. They didn't know it was totalitarianism at the time, but this was a new beast.
Why is Andrei Babichev the subject of Caballero's envy?
This is a sideline about Babichev. Do you know, in 1922, Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt was published in Russia.
Ah, so that inspired the title?
And I think that the name, mm-hmm, Babichev, comes from Babbitt.
So he's meant to be a Babbitt type.
He's kind of a Babbitt figure. And I think what Alyosha is implying is that although he has been a tremendous success in Russia, particularly under the new economic policy, in fact, he is the new incarnation of the bourgeois.
Would you read a passage from the opening of the novel?
I would love to read a passage. This is from the end of chapter one, and the he who's referred to is this Andrei Babichev.
The sausage mogul.
The sausage mogul, yes. He's a glutton. He eats anywhere but at home. Last night, he came back hungry and decided to have a bite to eat. Nothing in the pantry. He went downstairs, the store on the corner, and brought back a real haul, 250 grams of ham, a can of sardines, pickled mackerel, a big long loaf, a good half moon of Dutch cheese, 4 apples, 10 eggs, and Persian pea marmalade. He'd ordered an omelet and tea. The kitchen in the building is communal. It's manned by 2 cooks who take turns. "Put on the feed bag, Kavalyerov," he invited me, and fell to it himself. He ate the omelet straight from the skillet, chipping off pieces of egg white the way people chip enamel. His eyes grew bloodshot. He kept taking his pince-nez off and putting them back on. He smacked his lips, he snorted, and his ears wiggled. I entertained myself with observations. Have you ever noticed that salt falls off the end of a knife without leaving a trace? The knife shines as if untouched. That pince-nez traversed the bridge of a nose like a bicycle. That man is surrounded by tiny inscriptions, a sprawling anthill of tiny inscriptions on forks, spoons, saucers, his pince-nez frames, his buttons, and his pencils. No one notices them. They're waging a battle for survival. They move in and out of view. Even the huge sign letters, they rise up, class against class. The letters on the street plaques do battle with the letters on the posters. He stuffed himself silly. He reached for an apple with his knife, but only slit the apple's tawny peel before losing interest. Once in a speech, a people's commissar spoke of him with high praise. Andrei Babichev is one of the state's most remarkable men. He, Andrei Petrovich Babichev, is the director of the Food Industry Trust. He's a great sausage and pastry man and chef. And I, Nikolai Kavalyerov, am his jester.
Marin Schwartz reading from Yuri Olyesha's Envy, which she translated. I read this many years ago in a different translation. Mm-hmm. What necessitated a new translation?
That's a great question. I've been retranslating classics, and it's certainly not something one does lightly. There are a few reasons why one translates. Sometimes there's a new original edition discovered, a new manuscript. Sometimes the first edition is simply faulty in one or more ways. A third reason is that a translation has dated. And it's interesting that translations date in a way that original works don't. that could be an entire PhD dissertation. But one of the things that I was interested in doing was addressing some of the issues that the other translations had not done. For example, and I brought a few examples here, in the course of the novel, there are a few ditties, a few verses. And the previous translations hadn't attempted to create new verse, for one thing. They had more or less conveyed the semantic meaning of the verse. Well, one of the verses, for example, is of a different character we haven't spoken of, Ivan Babichev, and he's a major character. He's kind of a down and out, middle-aged man who frequents bars and tells people's fortunes and entertains them and has more serious issues as far as the plot goes, but he's a clown in some ways and a comic. I wouldn't say he is a comic figure, but his figure uses comic methods.
And that didn't come across in the earlier translation.
Well, there's one particular ditty that he speaks when he's being hauled out of the bar by the police. He turns to the crowd and declaims this verse, which he does more than once in the course of the book. And I'll read it to you in Russian. It's short. And you'll hear the rhythm. You'll hear it's almost doggerel. Ведь я не шарлатан немецкий и не обманщик я людей. Я скромный фокусник советский. Я современный чародей. I won't read you one of the other verses, but somehow the other one of them brought in John the Baptist. I'll read it to you. It said, I am not a foreign faker, neither am I John the Baptist. I'm a modern miracle maker. I'm a modest Soviet artist. Well, it almost rhymes, and it almost, I wouldn't say it's actually catchy. And it brings in this bizarre John the Baptist, which is not in the original. And I translated it as, no charlatan from Germany, deceit is not my game. I'm a modern day magician with a Soviet claim to fame. So I worked very hard on those. There was a kind of a comic one that in Russian goes, Вучтреждение шум и тарарам, все давно смешалось там. Машинистке, Лизочке, Каплан, подарили барабан. Which I translated as, at the institute, what's all the clatter? What's all the fuss? What's the matter? Lizochka, the typist, Blum is banging on her gift, a drum. And the comic element has to come through in those things. So that was one of the things that I was trying to get. Or the name of the cafeteria that was being built, that was going to be a communal paradise, was a word that most of the other translations translated as the quarter, which is a little confusing in English. I translated it as the two bits.
My guest is Marion Schwartz, translator of Yuri Alyesha's Envy, which is the subject of this underappreciated segment. It was published in, as we said, in the early years of Stalin's reign. Was censorship as entrenched then as it became later? Were the censors just totally oblivious to what Alyesha was doing at that time?
This was the beginning of the censorship. The censors were actually paying attention, but they didn't get it. They didn't get the note of, they didn't get the irony.
And it got a glowing review in Pravda.
It got a glowing review in Pravda. Within the immediately thereafter, he turned it into a play.
And was that the problem? Was the play a little more explicit and easier for them to figure out?
I haven't heard anyone say that. Perhaps I think probably it was simply pointed out to them that this is not a positive depiction of the Soviet ethos.
But he wasn't punished the way some other writers were. Babel and many other dissident writers were sent to the gulag. Some were even executed. Alyesha was allowed to live out the rest of his life, although he didn't continue to write.
Correct. He did not. He was never arrested, as far as I could tell. He certainly wasn't imprisoned. What he did was to keep a very low profile. He wrote criticism for Literaturna Gazeta. He wrote screenplays. And during the war, he was exiled to Turkmenistan, where he wrote war propaganda, radio scripts, film scripts. He kept enough to, as I said, enough to keep his dacha in Peredelkina. But he was more or less a broken man. Actually, I think he translated as well. I've read that.
And he died in 1960. I mean, here's a writer who's very ambitious in this book. Many of the most vivid scenes in the novel don't even take place. Kavalyarov admits to the reader that he's made them up. He's playing with the reader and playing with a character who is, you know, rather unappealing.
Quite unappealing. Quite unappealing, which is why it got by the censors. Because he is an unappealing man. There actually aren't very many appealing people in the entire book. The book is often characterized as being a funny book, but I must say, every time I read it, I get queasier and queasier. I think that it's a tragic book, and the devices are comic, but I don't find it funny anymore.
Were the drawings that appear throughout the book in the original?
Yes, they were, and I take entire credit. This is Natan Altman, who was a very well-known and respected artist in the period, and the edition that I was translating from had these drawings in them, and Edwin Frank at New York Review Books obtained the rights to them.
Now, Nabokov, do I say Nabokov or just Nabokov?
Nabokov
called this the greatest novel produced during the Soviet Union, and that seems like a wild claim. There were some pretty good books written, but where would you place this?
Well, Nabokov said that relatively early, I believe. Of course, we didn't know a lot of what was being written in the Soviet Union. Where would I place it? I would place it very high. I wouldn't place it above Master and Margarita. I think Alyosha was more limited than Bulgakov in a lot of ways.
Solzhenitsyn, of course, wrote.
Solzhenitsyn.
But these are all famous writers. Alyosha is kind of forgotten.
Alyosha is forgotten, which is why we're lucky to be talking about him today.
And the book, Envy, with a new translation by Marion Schwartz, my guest, is now available from New York Review Books. It has an introduction by Ken Kalfas. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us on today's Underappreciated.